We're getting ready for our second session this afternoon. Really, our third session, including the keynote. I'm Dale Rosengarten, curator at the Jewish Heritage Collection. Ann Medden, former president of the Historical Society. Ann Medden Hellman has said that I need to tell everyone that we are recording oral histories and have been since 1995. That's not just a possibility in the future, but it's a live opportunity right now. We've got this wonderful, very easy recording equipment. We could even get a little committee going in the PD to do oral history. And the Historical Society helps us support the process of transcribing and putting the oral histories online. So that's a real opportunity. I've been asked to introduce the moderator of our panel. This is a panel about South of the Border and the legend of Alan Schaefer. We're privileged to have one of Alan's sons, one nephew, a sister, and a niece on the panel. And I know Harold's related, too. But I don't know how. Harold Cornflute graduated from Latta High School in 1971, attended the University of Georgia, received a BBA in accounting in 1975. He worked as a staff accountant in Columbia, South Carolina from 1975 to 82, and moved to Latta in 1982 to work as a self-employed CPA. He's married to Susan Mazur Cornblut of Birmingham, Alabama. They have one child, Jennifer K. Kalinsky of Birmingham, Alabama. I believe she's a graduate of the College of Charleston. Is that true?
MUSC.
He served on PD Regional Transportation Authority as a member of the Board of Directors and as chairman from 92 to 94. Harold's a member of the Latta Rotary Club and past president of the Dalcho Lodge No. 160, past master and treasurer, Omar Shrine Temple, Charleston, and Dillon County Rifle and Gun Club as treasurer for the last 18 years. He's the last president of Ohav Shalom Congregation in Dillon, South Carolina. He's been a member of Beth Israel in Florence since 1986, serving on the board most of that time as on various committees. He's currently chairman of Beth Israel Congregation Foundation and president of the Florence Hebrew Benevolent Society Cemetery. His hobbies include British sports cars, motorcycling, boating, fishing, bait shrimping, we don't like that in McClellanville, and golf. I've known Harold really since the beginning of the society. He's been an extremely important and supportive member. He's one of the guys who's always calling me and saying, Dale, I have something for you, and then he brings it. It's really, we've had a really remarkably constructive relationship over all these years, and as a result, we have some materials on the Dillon congregation, on the Florence congregation. So I'm personally indebted to Harold and very happy that he has offered to moderate this panel. I'm going to let him describe the order of events because this is a multimedia panel. We're going to have a film, we're going to have discussion, and we'll have Q&A. So Harold, I'm going to hand you the mic.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. We're going to start with a little bit about a history of the Schaefer Company. My grandmother was a Schaefer, and her brother, Sam Schaefer, is a sister to Evelyn and to Richard's father Joe and to Robin's father, Richard's father Alan and Robin's father Joe, excuse me, and to Diane's father Joe, they started out in the beverage business. At least Alan told me that in an interview a number of years ago. Really, right after the Depression and after Prohibition, or during the Depression, after Prohibition, and they started. I think Alan related to me that they brought one ton truck with a friend, a black man, and they drove to Baltimore and bought beer on the street and brought it back to Little Rock, South Carolina, put it out in pails, and quickly found that the customers that couldn't pay for the groceries in the store would pay a dollar for a bottle of beer, cash. And I think that got him into the beer business. He decided that was what he wanted to be in. Now, Richard was born in 1949. Robin was born in 51.
That would be rude.
Okay. Diane is much younger. Much. And Evelyn is almost like another sister, and we won't mention her date of birth, but Evelyn was the youngest child, or was Joe younger than you?
Joe
was younger than you. Okay.
But
I will tell. I will tell you that my Uncle Sam had three wives, not all at the same time. He lost his first. He lost his first wife to the flu epidemic of 1918. He remarried, and his second wife died. The first two children, Alan and Charles, and Charles August were by the first wife. She was from Baltimore. Her name was Wilhelmina Heller. And she died in the flu epidemic of 1918. The second wife, Ray Rosenfeld, had a child named Ray, and she died in childbirth. And the third wife, Aunt Betty, had two children, Evelyn being the older and Joe being the younger.
She buried him.
Very good. Right.
The reason that's important is because my wedding band is her wedding band.
Yeah. Right.
And my husband's in deep trouble.
Yeah. And so they got into the beer business. Joe was more into the gasoline business. And that became when part of the South of the Border got started up. We've got a film that's going to show some things about mostly about the border. We wanted to first kind of tell you a few little things about the beverage business that they got into, and that was that during the Depression, he actually started in the business before the Depression, but during the Depression, they went into the bottling business. And you want to talk about a little bit about what they have here, Richard?
Well, before the Depression, the family had a mercantile store in Little Rock that my great-grandfather Abraham bought from Mr. Dillon himself. When Mr. Dillon moved to Dillon, to give the land to the railroad to run the railroad tracks through Dillon. So we have a lot of history with the Dillons. He wouldn't know that today, but we still do. But Abraham started a mercantile store in Little Rock, and Sam inherited it from Abraham. And my grandfather Sam died before I was born. He died in 45. I was born in 49. And that's going to be relevant because I and South of the Border are the same age. I was born in April. It was born in January of 49. So we've both been here about 63 years. But back to the beer business is where it all started. As Harold has told you, it started because of hard times and no money. And these little towns absolutely had no money. Now, Aunt Evelyn can go back further than I can, obviously, because she helped to go to Baltimore, Maryland to get the beer to bring it to Little Rock. So I'm going to let her tell that story. I'm not going there. But the beer was brought in from Baltimore, and as he said, the only thing we could get paid for, or Granddaddy could get paid for, was beer. Everything was sold on credit. Our first route man, his name was Shad Carmichael, the first employee of Schaefer Distributing Company. He was a black guy from Little Rock, and he was the first route salesman in the beer business in the state of South Carolina that I'm aware of. We were one of the first beer wholesalers in the state of South Carolina to actually have what is called a wholesale beer license. Early on, you didn't have to have a wholesale beer license. You just had to have a license. That let you sell retail or wholesale. Later on, they required that a wholesaler had to be a wholesaler and a retailer had to be a retailer. And that's a very interesting story, too. And that's how I ended up in the beer business. The beer business license was in my name. South of the Border's beer license was in Daddy's name because there had to be a division and separation of the situation for the licensing. But anyway, that's how the beer business started in Little Rock, South Carolina. And they would go to Baltimore, and Aunt Evelyn will tell you about the trips to Baltimore. And they'd bring back a state-bodied pickup truck load of beer, as much as they could get or afford. And then they'd sell it at the store. Well, pretty soon they got enough beer to keep an inventory. And that's when they started sending out, going out to the other communities to sell the beer. Am I right so far, Aunt Evelyn?
They took a young, there was a man named Dunk Tiner that worked with my father. He was white. And they would take, the salesman took Dunk, and they would give samples. Say, have you ever, because nobody had tasted beer in years. So they would go to Myrtle Beach. They had Roots that they started. And they gave Dunk tastes of beer. And by the end of the day, they would say, young man, how does that taste? He was supposed to be a stranger. And he said, I tell you the truth, that stuff tastes damn good. The trip to Baltimore was in, they got a pickup and Chad was the driver. I was young. My father took me everywhere. The truck had sides that you snap, and it would hardly make the hills going to Richmond. My father always shopped for wholesale grocers in Richmond. So we got off, but the car, the truck was all they could get. And we didn't get it from the street. We went to a brewery. My mother was from Baltimore, and she had family. One was in the Attorney General's office. So when beer was, when 1932, when everything was repealed, you couldn't get beer. But my mother knew people, and they got her a carload, and that's how I got on the trip. Yeah. We went up, and I remember the brewery. I was a little girl, and there was all these big, they were just opening the breweries in the cities, and water, beer all over the floor, and people trying to get it. So we could get a carload through political, whatever.
That was a real carload or a truck?
No,
or
it truck was a truck. Didn't have doors. It snapped on. Okay. And when Chad was driving, it wouldn't make the hills around Richmond. I never go through Richmond. But
Now, back before the 33 era, during Prohibition, we ended up in the bottling business because we had been in the wine business before, and Prohibition put us out of the beer business at that point in time, and we started bottling soft drinks. The soft drink that we bottled was called Ace High Cola, and that's two bottles that we have from that era. And as you can see, it's etched in that glass, so I'm not sure that those were the first bottles, but they were very early in the production. The building that housed Ace High Cola still stands today. And the wine business, we actually bought wine from Baltimore in railroad tanker cars. And the tanker would come to Little Rock, and they'd put it next to the wine warehouse that we called it. And they would hook hoses up to the tanker car and run the wine into the bottling plant and bottle the wine and then go sell it. So we got a long history in the alcohol business. Yeah. But after the beer business started, in 1933, well, south of the border wasn't born to 49. So he grew the beer business until that point in time. And then that's what created south of the border.
Now, when I was... I had asked Alan about what the origins of south of the border was, and he indicated to me that he showed me, and Richard has not been able to find it, but there was a two-bay garage that they stored beer in to sell to the customers in North Carolina. And that was because North Carolina, Robeson County, North Carolina, which is right across the border, had a very interesting local beer ordinance, local alcohol ordinance. They had a lot of local alcohol ordinances in North Carolina that said that you couldn't distribute beer in Robeson County. You could sell it retail, but you couldn't distribute it. And so he set up a garage. It looked like an old Exxon station with two roll-up bays, and they had refrigeration in it, and they stacked up case beer there for the customers in North Carolina to come across and buy it for their stores in North Carolina. Well, the story that Alan related to me at that time was that the governor of North Carolina at that time became very upset because the citizens in the elected officials in Robeson County were upset that they were flaunting the fact that there was a beer depot across the border, because it said south of the border beer depot. And so he got a phone call from the governor of South Carolina, Strom Thurmond, who recommended he drop the depot off the name. And so thereabouts came the name South of the Border as opposed to Beer Depot. And Richard has brought a picture of what South of the Border looked like, and I was just commenting myself as I was looking at this. Can I pass this around?
Sure.
Yeah. I want to pass this around. As I look at that picture, it reminds me of some of the old pictures of Las Vegas in 1950. I mean, it just kind of looks like the Sands Hotel or something, some of the pictures that would go back at that time. But that was the start of what happened with South of the Border, and it became a gas station and a fireworks business and a restaurant. And all this time, they were hiring quite a few minority employees that worked in food service and all other sources. I know as a young person myself in 1970, out of high school, I worked a summer job working in the new shop that was across the street by the interstate.
What was the
Mexico West Shop? Yes. And my manager at that time was a black man, Arnold Kenny, who I know today, who was working out at South of the Border.
From Lada.
And he outstanding training for people. I mean, it was really very good. We enjoyed working out there, although it was quite hectic at that time, I would say. And I know that Ben Bernanke worked out there with me, and I know that Nathan Goldman worked out there. Some of you were just asking about Nathan Goldman worked out there. Ben worked as a restaurant, and I worked in the shop, and I think Nathan worked in the shop with me. Did you ever work in that part, or did you work at the gas station?
Gas station.
You worked at the gas station.
And fireworks.
They had a tremendous gas station out there that apparently was the largest gas retail gas station in the East Coast.
For a while.
Yeah.
For a while.
I mean, it was, and your dad was in that. That was your dad's part. So that was Joe's part of the business that he was running in the gas as a gas distributor.
They fixed tires and all food.
They did tires, trucks, and tires and things like that, and it was quite a place. I know that my bar mitzvah was held upstairs in the top of the sombrero room, right? And they were building. And you'll see the picture of the sombrero, not the second sombrero, but the first one.
Right.
But the first sombrero, they were building that during the day during my bar mitzvah. I remember the cranes out there when they were building that. So, and I have appropriate pictures at home. Would you like to add on that about working in the? Would you like to add, Robin?
I will add one thing. To the last panel, I never even considered race relations at South of the Border. South Border, from my memory, it's always existed, right? And there was never three bathrooms ever. There was never two water fountains. I just never paid attention to it. I'm so used to in my family, and my dad and rest, all the Shaver family being fair in that area, I didn't even consider it to the last panel. And in Dillon, when I went to the movies for 10 cents, by the way, double feature cartoon, the black kids were upstairs in the balcony. And Casey Manning, who's a friend of ours and is a judge in, I think, Lexington County, at my dad's funeral, and he got to integrate our class in the ninth grade. He's a good friend. And Casey said, he said, you know, Joe was my friend. That's why I'm here. I said, I'm here for you too, but I'm and Diane, Barry. He said, but I'm here because Joe's my friend, because when I got out of law school, he hired me. Okay, and his words were, what was the people outside in Dillon said, what's the Jew doing with the color fella? Those are his Casey's words, being funny. But I just never even considered. And her mom, my grandmother, used to I remember her handing out money by B.C. Moore's in the post office to black people. I can remember her doing that. So that's my comment. Okay,
Diane, Evelyn.
I'll add to this because this is sort of my contribution for what it's worth. And I think it was actually things sort of happen. And if you look back at the history and how things began and how they were set up, there were a number of forces that came together, because if you look at the South, and if you look at South Carolina as opposed to Alabama, as opposed to Mississippi, we lacked the violence in South Carolina during the period of immigration that existed throughout the South. We didn't have it. And we didn't have it as a result of significant individuals who happened to find themselves around the state. And I talked to Casey yesterday because Judge Manning, who is a colleague of mine and a dear friend. And as we talked, I said, I want to tell a story about you, but I want to, A, get your permission, and B, be sure that I'm relatively accurate. And he said, sure, of course, go right ahead. So, you know, we talked about Uncle Alan a little bit, and he told me a couple of stories that I was unaware of, and he gives the source back to Uncle Alan, and they really dovetailed to make a difference, to really make a difference in our part of the world. We also had a very dynamic sheriff in our county who is kids study integration, and they study politics in South Carolina. They actually are talked about. Uncle Alan has talked about, Carl Knight has talked about, and they talk about their influence. Morris Rosen, we just lost Morris Rosen a couple of weeks ago. He's one of those people that was placed in Charleston who was a moving force to move South Carolina ahead so that we didn't have the violence that was in existence around the South. And what Casey was telling me, Judge Manning was telling me yesterday, was that he says the story about how Uncle Alan became very involved in politics obviously became very, very important in terms of the lack of animus during a period of desegregation. But it's a neat story. It says that at the store, that there was a very substantial bag of sugar that was stolen. And I always wondered about why they had so much sugar at that store, but that's for another moment. But in any event, and Uncle Alan knew there was a witness, because there was somebody in the store, associated with the store, that knew who took the sugar. And Casey was relating this as having happened back in the 40s. So Richard was when either before you were born or when you were a baby. And he said that what happened was he went to the sheriff, and the sheriff told him, gave him two choices. He said, if you leave it alone and you don't ask for a warrant, I'll get you half your sugar back. Otherwise, you get none of your sugar back. And supposedly, it infuriated him. And at that point, he was willing to spend the time, energy, and effort to get involved politically, and he got involved politically. And the next election, whoever that sheriff was defeated. Well, at that point, politics is addicting, and apparently he loved it. And as I have grown, and I'm married to a man who was both in the House and the Senate as a young man and highway commissioner, so politics, and I'm watching my generation, watching my children fall in love with politics. It's, thank God, it's important. So here you have a person who's become involved in politics, who's become involved in who the sheriff is in this county. you add that to a person who is raised around a religious ceremony, that at the gravamen of it, and at the gravamen, at the soul of the Passover ceremony, it's about never, never excluding the stranger, who is the stranger within your midst. And it's, and the whole service is about tolerance. And if Jews are nothing else, they are tolerant. And so those forces, if you will, dovetailed so that at the time of integration, there was no violence. Certainly in Dillon, although I would like to, I'm the only person that I know had a cross burned for their benefit when I was growing up in Dillon. But be that as it may, you've got that powerful influence that was someone who happened to be tolerant. An example of that is that Casey Manning, my beloved colleague, my brother's beloved friend, when they integrated, was the first black player at the University of South Carolina to play basketball at the University of South Carolina for Frank McGuire. Well, anybody that knew my uncle knew that he and Frank McGuire, you know, they were brothers from another mother. I mean, they were incredibly close. And Judge Manning talks about the fact that Uncle Allen was a force, because it was a tremendous decision for Frank McGuire to make the decision to integrate the basketball program at South Carolina. Easier for him coming from New York, probably, but very difficult in that he was the coach at South Carolina. And the first game that Casey played, Uncle Allen sent him roses. He sent him celebratory roses, that he had made it, that he had survived the integration, and that he'd actually played basketball. The other story, then I'm done. This is my other story. And Casey, I'm just going to forget it. Casey tells a story also back in the 40s that one, and it's ironic with your relationship with the Shriners.
Right.
My husband is a Shriner. Barry is a Shriner. My brother is a Shriner. Dad was ridiculously a Shriner. And I don't know how they...
My father.
Yes. Absolutely.
My father, too, and my grandfather. They were all...
Yeah. They all came
into the Masonic Lodge.
They did, but there's a relationship...
Excuse me. They still give big charity to the Shriners.
And that's...
We have...
Yes, ma'am.
We have 10-cent nickel things that could win on cars for years. They won't sell them, but if you give a donation, you can have them for a dime, and all of that every day at the border goes to the Shriners.
And the story is, according to Judge Manning, is that there was an event, and it was before any Jews were Shriners or in the Masonic Lodge. And yet Uncle Allen was incredibly supportive of the Shriners. And the story that was relayed to me by Casey was that the Grand Wizard of the KKK was sitting next to him at an event and had something very ugly to say. I don't know what it was. I can only imagine what it was. And yet in the face of that, not for one moment did the support that he gave to the Shriners ever wane. He made it of no moment. He opened the space for that sort of horrific, horrific discrimination. And y'all probably know more about that than I do. But he was sharing that story with me yesterday, which I found to be fairly remarkable. That he, and I'm confident it is because of what at the end of the day that what they did was help kids.
I'd like to comment on Diane's comments on integration. I go back before integration, so I went to school at public schools before they were integrated. There was trouble. I mean, there was, in my whole recollection of growing up, there was always prejudice, as much against Jews as it was against blacks. So in public school, we really got a double dose of it. And that was before they went to school. So I grew up with the blunt of it in the last era of it. I can remember vividly waking up at night and having crosses burned in my yard at home as a kid. I can remember that as an adult, having crosses burned in my house where I live now. So it wasn't quite as peaceful as most would think, but my father and his political situation, his political stands were self-preservation. He loved politics later in life, but early on it was purely to protect him from the powers that be that were doing the things that Diane has spoken about, because there was that kind of prejudice against Jewish people in Dillon County. And every business he operated, he either got boycotted or there was some problems back and forth, licensing and things like that, like south of the border, had tremendous problems with licensing. And all of it stemmed from that period of time when there was that kind of prejudice. So it wasn't quite as calm in that period of time as you may not know if you didn't live through it. I was in the National Guard and was activated in 1970 for race riots. So there were race riots still going on throughout South Carolina, violent ones, even at the University of South Carolina where I attended during that period of time while I was in the National Guard. So, but pretty much after that, it calmed back down. But
I can recall, during that period of time that we didn't have I don't remember really any outright violence in our schools when we came to integration. I think that actually went fairly well, but there was a lot of footwork that had to be laid to make that happen, and I think Diane kind of hit the point there that there was some people out there that were doing some work that got that laid out in my particular schools. Latta, when we merged with the black school that was across town, they didn't just move those black students over to Latta High School. They changed the mascot, they changed the school colors, they changed everything, so everybody had to make a sacrifice. And nobody was happy. But that made everybody mad. But I think in the long run, it made for a peaceful transition.
The other piece of that is when it came time for African Americans to register to vote, which had the history of the South, not just South Carolina, was replete in its attempt to keep African Americans from registering to vote. It's pretty sad with this election cycle, the attempts that have been ongoing again to affect minorities' ability to vote. It's really disturbing personally to me. But I always chalked up, particularly with regard to Carl Knight, who I adored, who was the sheriff of Dorchester County, and I am absolutely convinced that Uncle Alan knew the same. Those were some great votes. So they were visionaries, and they understood that the addition of those folks, black people who had so many places that were being blocked to register to vote, they understood that by holding out a hand up, if you will, that they were sort of adding to the numbers of Democrats too. So it was pretty brilliant, as well as being pretty tolerant.
You want to start the film now? You think it's about a good time to run the film?
Let me just say.
Can I have a question, please?
Yeah. Yeah, we'll take your question after this film.
I left and I came back, and one of Alan's stories, let me back up a minute. The one thing that
was very big about south of the border when it began. We are on the border, as you know, and on the other side, if people are not from there, are the Lumbee Indians, large amount. We never mixed with them as kids. It was a border. And when he opened the border, he opened black help, Indian help, white help. And nobody had ever been hired to have black people be waiters and waitresses at that time, and certainly not Indians. And every one of them were welcome. And one of Alan's stories to me before he died was he was at the border, and the Ku Klux Klan was after him. And they marched up, and he got a gun. I can't imagine him with a rifle. And he said he came out and said, if anybody comes near, we will shoot them. They were mad because of the integration. And he told that story. I don't know what year.
Most of the traveling public thought that our local Indians were Mexicans.
Oh, yeah.
That's the truth.
Well, Robinson County is about 50-60% Indian. I mean, it's the origins of Robinson County.
Yeah, they surprised we don't speak Spanish at the border. We get that all the time.
You want to run the film?
Sure. Yeah, question.
Oh, we're going to do a question before or after? We do your question afterwards? Okay. Okay, after the film.
And that was made by two undergraduates at the College of Charleston.
Right.
And it's just, 15 minutes of an hour long?
Something
like that?
The personnel director handles that, and she said two students would like, and they always told me to interview them because, you know, they show up. Well, these undergraduates looked like they were professors. They weren't kids. But they asked questions, so I sat down and talked to them. There was more. However, there's more to this movie that is better because they interviewed some of the managers, and it's good. They probably cut it out. And the other part of this film was done 20 years ago, 15. The girl talking, we don't know. She did that on another film years ago.
We wanted to come forward with just a few things, I think, maybe to relate to Alan's life and to what I guess was his world view, I guess. And I know that Alan was quite active in politics. Really, his father, Uncle Sam, was quite active in politics and became chairman of the Democratic Party in Dillon County, and used I would say a minority power base out of Little Rock in order to help establish his political base. Alan related to me that many of his political stands were really protective stands to help him protect himself from enemies that were trying to put him out of business. And one example of that was related to me, not by him, but by other people in the community, was that the Dillon County Economic Development Commission actually voted to try to have I-95 moved to Marlborough County when it was trying to determine the course of how I-95 was to be routed. They actually wanted to move it west over to Marlborough County to keep it away from Alan Schaefer's 500 employees and his business there, okay, which made no absolute sense because, as has been related, at least to me, the original plans for I-95 called for it to parallel the Atlantic Coast Line Railroad, the Wilson Shortcut Railroad, which has no turns in it, from Florence, South Carolina to Wilson, North Carolina. It's a straight shot. And that's the route that bypassed Wilmington. That's the reason the towns of Lida and Dillon and all these other towns are there, is because the railroad came that way.
They thought it bypassed Charleston.
and it bypassed. It actually went from north of Sumter. The bypass, the Wilson bypass, came from Florence to Wilson, North Carolina, and I-95 was going to follow parallel that, because the railroad is what, 200 yards west of south of the border. It's right there, and so is the railroad. But individuals in high places, including Dillon County, was trying to have it moved, and certain people were trying to direct that happen, including the road commissioner in North Carolina, who at that particular time had to be paid off. I guess that's the right term. And his name was Lodge Faircloth, okay, who later became a U.S. Senator from North Carolina. But Lodge Faircloth at that time was the road commissioner for Robeson County, North Carolina. And that was how the road got turned. And if you ride down the 995, you'll notice it. It takes a prominent little turn there in order to make it connect. North Carolina didn't want it connect at that point, and South Carolina ended up developing an exit. And if you look at it, there are two exits right on top of each other. No, it's an amazing sight to look at from the air.
North Carolina was first.
Yeah, they were first.
South Carolina got embarrassed into an exit.
I mean, they're really right on top. The exits are actually run on top of each other.
And, right,
right. So, but there were people that did not want him to succeed. They resented his political activism, his ability to, or his willingness to hire blacks, and his willingness to use his political power, and that use of political power was used both to protect him, I think, and also I think he did it because he thought it was the right thing. To hire people, to give people jobs. I don't think there was ever any discrimination out there at all.
At one time, some 20 years ago, south of the border has always been one of Dillon County's largest employers. The last summer I worked there before going back to Schaefer Distributing, we employed somewhere near 1,000 employees. Well, that was unheard of in Dillon, to have anything that has that kind of payroll. Since then, obviously, with the video poker going away and other changes and other competition, but we're still employing around 350 to 400 people. Where else are they going to get a job? I think one of the gentlemen a while ago made a very interesting statement. You can build all the spec buildings you want, but who's coming? Well, Dillon's in the process of trying to do another spec building. But I agree with that comment. Why are they coming? But and labor would be the answer to that. Cheap labor would be the only answer to that. But anyway, south of the border has always been one of the county's largest employers. It is also its largest taxpayer. I wish I could do something about the property taxes, but I can't. So it has been very beneficial for that interstate to come through there. And I think anybody to date it will tell you that. So it has been very a very powerful force in that economy. Yeah. Dillon County, I'm on the county school board, and I deal with sales tax. Dillon County in the state of South Carolina, its sales tax have been up for the last 3 years, while most counties in this state have been down in their sales tax collections. So you have to ask yourself why. Most of it's going to be, the answer is going to be that interstate. And the businesses that have been built from Latta all the way to North Carolina are the ones contributing highly to that commerce. So,
I work there, and one of the common questions I get once a day is, how did it end up that this exit was the south of the border? Because somebody wants an answer, and we tell them. One of Alan's story was that we had the highest electric bill in the state of South Carolina. They burned all these lights 24 hours. That South Carolina, if they took the exit away, they wouldn't have the big power bills. He told that story. Richard is now president. He cut out some of the lights. The state's after you. He cut out some. It was lit up all night. And customers would say, I would like to know how this place got right at the border. I mean, I wouldn't think to ask that of strangers, but they do.
You had a question.
Yeah.
I want to direct the question directly to Evelyn, please. Evelyn, did you attend the University of South Carolina?
I did.
Were you in the sorority around 1941?
I was.
Yeah, well, I've got a picture of you and I together. How about that? I've been sitting here looking at you. Maybe you'd recognize me. I didn't recognize you.
What?
I'm Betty Hirsch. Betty Lanza.
Yeah. Now, wait a minute. Were you from Columbia?
Charleston. No, Charleston.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
You want to see you?
Oh, my God.
Okay. Yeah. Are there any questions? We'd like to. We'd certainly field questions from the field here on.
I'd like to make an observation.
Uh-huh.
The first time I was at South of the Border was in December and January between 1960 and 1961. I was 9 or 10, and my family was headed to Florida for a vacation. And like so many of us, we pulled off and we got some food and some stuff to take on the road and some gas and some souvenirs. And my impression was, why would anyone come here? And so, advance the calendar a few years, I'm in the midst of my second marriage and my wife is taking on a job as a high school teacher in Hartsville, and I'm still living in Detroit trying to find a job in South Carolina. And so I'm down on a weekend conjugal visit, and I says, have you been to South of the Border yet? The kitsch there is so amazing, you won't believe it. She says, well, I've heard about it, but I've never been there. So I took her. And the place was like somewhere around 8 or 10 times the size it was in 1960. And the kitsch hadn't changed a bit. It was just way more of it. It was just over the top. And that's just an incredible display of brilliant business acumen. Just amazing.
I'd like to make a comment. South of the Border was a hobby to my father. It was built purely out of hard work and devotion, because from 1949 on, he was totally devoted to that business. As soon as any son became of age, we were shipped off to the beer company to run it, and he went south of the border. As a kid, every Sunday, we had to go to south of the border, every Sunday. And he worked 7 days a week, 365 days a year. I have never known since or before any person that devoted to his business. His whole life was centered around that business. Well, at the same time, he operated one of the biggest beverage companies in the state of South Carolina, probably the largest Miller franchise in the United States of America, the top 10 Heineken franchise in the United States, and all he did is drive by it to get south of the border. He might call you once a month to see if everything was all right, but that's all you ever heard. It was all south of the border. And
why don't you tell him the story about the Miami High Life?
Okay. Miami High Life... He was Jewish, as you know, or I probably wouldn't be here. Fred Miller, who was the chairman and principal owner of Miller Brewing Company, called him up one day and said, Alan, we've got a franchise in Miami High Life, and we have got to have somebody of the Jewish faith to take it over. And you're our only Jewish wholesaler in the United States of America. They're very anti-Semitic, and if we don't put a Jewish wholesaler there, we're going to have to close it. because they're not going to do business with anybody else but a Jewish wholesaler. And he said, well, I'll go down there, Fred, and look at it. And they went down there and looked at it, and Daddy comes back, just before my time now, and says, okay, I'll take it. It was two counties, Miami-Dade and DeVard. And Fred asked him, said, how many months is it going to take you to get this up and running? He said, oh, I'll be up and running by the end of the month. He said, the end of the month? He said, you don't have a building? You don't have a... He said, oh, I already leased the building. He said, and Jim Ryder will be here shortly to talk to me about a fleet of trucks. Well, Jim Ryder had never had a leased truck to a beer business or a beer truck, beer vehicle in his fleet. He had just started also. And they put a plan together, and that's how Miami High Life was taken over. And some, it was in about 1958, Aunt Evelyn, 57, 58, when he sold Miami High Life, 59. It's in the mid-50s. And a guy from Texas came in and offered to buy it, and he'd never heard of this guy, didn't know him from Adam's house cat, but this guy needed a reason to be in Miami, so he was a very wealthy multimillionaire and offered Daddy an enormous amount of money. He didn't even know how much money that was, he said. That he had no idea how many zeros were in that figure. And that was in the late 50s. And all of that money from Miami High Life is what funneled into South of the Border to grow it to what it is, or to get it on the path that it went to then. So it's kind of interesting that it all started from the beer business. We have a question about
that. Just curious to know if anybody on the panel can take responsibility for the road signs.
That is a very good question.
Are you responsible?
No, wait a minute. There is nobody living that is responsible. We're maintainers. We're not responsible. When he became ill, we were all very concerned about that one aspect of the business. The other aspects of the business we could handle. We'd been born, reared, and raised in his businesses, so that was not a concern. And basically what he was doing at the end of his life was billboard. He was, as Aunt Evelyn said, a journalist. Every billboard is written by him. He would stay awake at night. He was kind of a night person. He didn't come to work in the daytime after 1 o'clock, and he would work to 1 or 2 or 3 in the clock in the morning. And most of what he did is design those signs. He loved to design the signs. He would change 300 billboards faster than you could blink an eye. And that's why he started his own billboard company, because the outside company couldn't keep up with changing them fast enough to suit him. Because every time he had some kind of political statement or some other statement he wanted to make, he changed billboards. So, I mean, he got in trouble with the government one time for one of them looked like a dollar bill. And he turned it upside down and said, this sign is planned in Washington. Well, you'll never believe how quick the IRS got there to talk to him about that sign. So,
I heard those billboards were all hand-painted. Is that right?
Originally, they were hand-painted. In the later years, it became more economical to have them done by computer and put on computer. And now they're being done by a computer-generated model. And we can change out 5 signs a day, whereas before it would take us a week to change 2. So now they're all on plastic, and we can rehang them and move them, and we can put a sign anywhere today. So there, I don't know the exact count. The last head count I had was around 300. And some of them we own, most of them we lease from landholders.
Do you have the whole collection back to the very beginning?
Basically.
Have you ever thought about publishing a book?
Right now we're too busy trying to keep up with what he did. So. But no, Before he died, he had printed out, people ask how you going to maintain the billboard copy. He had printed out, he had written copies that's very high, stacks beside his bed of billboard copy. So it'll probably be my great-grandchildren that'll have to worry about new copy for it. So he, and you're starting to see some of the new ones pop up, and we're changing color patterns and things like that, but all the copy still is. So.
Ready? Are there any other questions?
Uncle Jaime Marcus said that he was roommates with Alan at USC.
Who?
Jaime Marcus.
Jaime Marcus.
That's probably correct. Judge Bubba Ness, and I think all three of them probably were roommates. I've heard
and
the name.
Second part. I was wondering where Alan was during World War II, because our dad, Harry Marcus, said that he had ridden with him on a train back from the West Coast, I thought. And I just wondered, because I know our dad was in the Philippines and New Guinea, but I didn't know where Alan was, how they had met up to be on the train.
He was stateside, from what I know. He was in Fayetteville. I do know one time. Aunt Evelyn might know better than I do about that.
Alan, I had a brother, a brother, right? That he,
yeah.
Well, he was stationed all out in the Pacific, and he would be the one if he rode a train. He was a Marine, and he's living in the village even now. He's older than I am. But Alan might have gone out in their own business, but not during the war.
I think Alan would have already been in and out of the service by then.
Yeah.
I think Alan was already in and out of the service by the time of the Second World War. So.
No, no.
Huh?
No?
Was he out?
No, Alan was in Fort Bragg.
But that was after, was that before?
During the war.
During the war, okay. During the war.
They got, he had Billy. They had a kid, your brother. But he was able to be at Fort Bragg. My father was very, very sick. And I think probably there was some reason, because there were a lot of family, a lot of business, a lot of stuff involved.
Given his business acumen, he may have been in logistics. Fort Bragg was a major marshaling center for getting him to Fort Bragg.
He was a supply. Mm-hmm. He was in supply.
Okay, well, I want to thank all our panelists. Any more questions? Thank you.
Yes. Go ahead.